Accession number 7242, Reel 1.
Mr. Kiddy, Reel 1. Where were you born, Mr. Kiddy?
In Newton-on-Ouse, a small village 7 or 8 miles north of York.
Which year was that?
1914, November.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a labourer, ex-Boer War veteran, and then he was a farm labourer for the remainder of his life.
Where did you go to school?
Newton-on-Ouse, the Church of England primary school.
And how old were you when you left school?
14.
To do what?
Just odd jobbing, and eventually I got a job on the farm living in. But I saw no sense or reason in working for pittances which you got on the farm, on the farms in those days. So when I was about 16 and a half, August 1931, I'd be 16 and three quarters, I nipped off to Fulford Barracks in York and joined the West Yorkshire Regiment, giving my age as 18. They fell for it, and I then served 7 years in the army as a man.
Now, can we go on to the war period, and can you tell me how you got your posting to East Africa?
Yes, I was recalled from the reserve. I'd finished in August 38, and in August 39, on the 26th, which actually was my date of enlistment in 31, the 26th of August, I was recalled from the reserve and immediately posted to the battalion in was serving then in Palestine, as it was, not Israel, Palestine. I embarked on the 3rd of November, the same day as the war started, from Gourock in Scotland, and disembarked in Haifa, I don't know the date at this stage, and joined the 2nd Battalion in Sarafand in Palestine.
So how did the East Africa posting come about?
On the we embarked in December at Haifa for posting to East Africa to the 5th Indian Division, disembarking at Port Sudan on the 1st of January 1940.
Did they tell you that you were going to East Africa?
We had no idea where we were going. We got on a troop ship and it sailed, and we had with us a lot of regular soldiers who had served in that area, and they picked the route out very quickly and they said it looks very much as though we're heading for the Sudan. And when Port Sudan hove in sight, we had quite a lot of kids who had, well, they were old men compared with me, who had served in Khartoum in the Sudan in the 1920s.
What was the voyage like?
Rough. We were on pre-war troop ships. I don't know if you've ever experienced travel on pre-war troop ships, but combined with the rough conditions on the normal troop ships, the equatorial heat was a bit grim, and we didn't enjoy the trip a great deal.
When you got to Port Sudan, what were your first impressions?
Well, the heat seemed a bit grim, and apart from that, we didn't get much contact with the natives. We saw them out fishing in the little, I just forget what the little Arab boats are called now, feluccas or something like that. And it seemed a very inhospitable area, you know, to say the least, to people who hadn't been abroad much before. I had pre-war service in Palestine, but not pre-war tropical intensity heat, which really bashed down on you. And you know, when you got to Port Sudan and started disembarking, it was really hot.
Did you have any special clothing compared with what you'd had in Palestine?
No, it was we were in tropical gear, shorts, short putties or anklets, and we were prepared. We had no khaki drill with us or a battle dress or anything like that at that stage of the war. We were fitted for service in the East.
Did any of the troops go down with sickness at this stage?
Not at that stage. I think we were fairly well looked after transport wise. We got on a all steel train. It was a bit cattle truck affair to go to our destination, which was Khartoum. But we had nothing really to complain about. We were used to travelling rough. We were young and resilient, and it didn't affect us unduly.
Was it just your battalion who had made the voyage?
Yes, it was our battalion, because we were going to an Indian division, which was the 5th, posted specially from India for that campaign. I think it was Major General Heath who was commanding it at the time, I'm not quite sure. And the brigades in those times were made up of 3 Indian divisions and 1 white battalion. I don't know where the other white battalions came from for the rest of the brigades in the division. Probably there already. But we were, as I say, we were in Sadafand, and we were rushed there to complete this division up to fighting strength, or training for fighting strength.
Was your unit up to strength?
Our unit was pretty well up to strength. We had joined in early September 39, sailed on the 3rd, as I said, and there were several hundred reservists on that ship, and they brought the battalion, 2nd battalion it was, well up to strength. I should say near the 1,000 mark, which was about right in those days.
Were you all regulars, or did you...?
We were all ex-regulars, and the battalion were all regulars. We had no militiamen at that time. We didn't get those until later years when we went to the desert.
What about your equipment?
I don't think there was any shortage of equipment. It was rather old-fashioned equipment compared with the stuff being used in the European theatres, I think. We hadn't any armoured cars that I can remember. We just had the 3-tonners, the 1,500 weights, and probably a few of the old Carden Lloyd machine gun carriers, but we had nothing comparable with the equipment being used in the European theatre.
What about your weapons?
Well, we were armed at that time with rifles and Bren guns and mortar platoon. That was about it for... We had no anti-tank rifles of any note, because I don't think tanks were expected much in that theatre. Where we were going to fight, it was too hilly, the Abyssinian terrain we were destined for, and it was a hilly, rocky country.
How many Bren guns would you have had?
Well, actually, I was more on the admin side than the training side, but I can hardly hazard a guess. I think we must have had in the region of 50 or 60, probably more. I'm not at all sure on that point.
What were your own duties with the battalion?
At that time, I was in the order room, as an order room clerk on the administrative side. It's the bridge of the troops are in the boiler room, the fighting troops, but the bridge is the CO and the adjutant and his staff. And administrative more than training.
Once you got to Khartoum, what happened next?
In Khartoum, it was a very sedentary life, really. We had a lot of sport, mostly in the evening, of course, because of the heat. We did training exercises on the scrub and the desert outside Khartoum, and I was always with the commanding officer, or the adjutant as a clerk, making notes on the success or otherwise of the training schemes. And I do remember one training scheme where a column was sent out to put an attack in on Khartoum City, and the defences were prepared by another unit, and I think it was about a 5 mile away, 5 miles away from Khartoum, the attack started. There was a sort of a 0 hour from when the attack began, and then the Khartoum defender, the officer defending Khartoum, he sent his scouts out to intercept and probe and push around and see what the strengths of the opposition were. And in the elephant grass and the scrub, they completely missed each other, did the attackers and the defenders. And I do remember the ensuing inquest when the umpires were all called in to give their verdict. The column commander who attacked Khartoum claimed that he had captured the city. And there's no doubt about it, he had done. He'd missed the defenders, or they'd missed him. But we had a pre-war, First World War major, second in command, and I well remember that he said, well, it would take you at least 3 days in wartime for the for your cannons and artillery to pound the wire down before you could get into Khartoum. Whereupon the old second in command, quoting his First World War experience, said, no, I'm sorry, it wasn't the same. The man who put the attack in on Khartoum said, well, it is wartime, and I'm here, I'm in the city. But he still wouldn't have that. He was still harping back to the First World War when it took 48 hours or 72 hours to break the wire down with the bombardments. But at the same time, half of Europe had fallen to the mechanised transport of Guderian and Rommel and people like that. Half of Europe was subdued, mechanised warfare. And he was still talking in terms of the First World War tactics and things like that, which didn't actually work out very well.
What did the main problem seem to be about training under African conditions?
Under African conditions, it was the intense heat. 100 and odd was a regular everyday occurrence, 100 and odd in the shade. And we had with us people who had been serving in Khartoum and the Sudan a decade before, and in those days they were wearing spine pads, you know, as a protection against the heat. But all that had gone by then. You know, by the 1940, we were training for almost a year before we went into action. But the spine pad part of it had gone. But we still had heat exhaustion and a lot of sores with the scrub and the prickly acacia, something like that they call the trees, with great thorns on about 3 inches long. And we did have a lot of heat exhaustion and desert sores, as we became to know them later on. When we got onto the desert, there was actually sand in the sores and the scratches, and you could soon become infected badly.
How were the sores dealt with?
They had a blue dye they used to put on. I don't know the medical name. Everybody was walking about with blue heads and arms and legs, and where they got liberal doses of this. I don't think we ever got anything internally for it, but we did get loads of this blue dye plastered all over us.
Was it effective?
It was fairly effective.
How many troops were made ineffective by these complaints?
I wouldn't like to put a real figure. I think about 5% sick parade most mornings when we got nearly down to training. But not a lot of hospitalisation.
Were there any other troops in Khartoum besides your battalion?
No, not in Khartoum. They were stationed in Atbara and Port Sudan. And I think there were troops at Kassala. But I'm not, as I say, it's 40 odd years ago. I couldn't sort of bank on that statement. Khartoum, Atbara and Kassala, as far as I know.
How long did you stay at Khartoum?
Almost a year, training and sport and swimming, keeping fit. And then just before Christmas of 1940, we moved off into the Galabat area on the frontier of Abyssinia.
Whilst you were at Khartoum, did you have much contact with the local population?
Not the lower ranks. My recollection is that we were on par with India and Singapore and places like that. Nobody wanted to know the lower ranks, the European population in Abyssinia. Khartoum, Sudan, kept themselves very much to themselves, except for mingling with the officers. But we were never invited into the lower ranks. I was a sergeant by then, but nobody wanted to know you. We made our own enjoyment. We had our own concerts and just local talent out of the battalion. We had football and tennis, hockey. But just for mingling with the... No, it was not on, ever, not to my knowledge.
Did the other ranks feel annoyed about this?
I don't think we had any strong views on it. We knew they were a bit snooty as far as British troops were concerned, but I think the British troops' conduct, you know, in these far-off areas, they brought it mostly upon themselves. I think that's why we weren't very welcome.
What about the Sudanese population? Did you have much contact with them?
Only the people who were employed in the barracks. You know, dobies and cobblers and people like that. Got all our washing done and ironed and for a few pence a week. And that's the only contact we had.
How did the troops get on with the Sudanese?
Oh, fairly well, especially the soldiers, the Sudanese Defence Force. I think we thought a lot about them, and I think they thought a lot about us. We got on well with those people. They were good, clean, smart lads with the Sudanese soldiers. They only had one thing. We used to confuse them with the Egyptians. So when we, you know, we didn't really know that Sudan, the population of the Sudan, the worst thing you could call them was an Egyptian. They didn't like that at all. They were a cut above the Egyptians in their estimation and in ours. We got on far better with them than with the Egyptian troops.
Could you speak with them?
Well, I don't think I knew above four or five people in the battalion who could speak Arabic. About two officers, and I can only remember about three other ranks who could speak Arabic. Actually, when it comes to linguistics, I think they're a lazy race. The soldiers just thought, well, everybody can speak English, and they never bothered to speak Arabic. And there was chances and scope for it. You could, I should think it must be the easiest thing in the world. Looking back in retrospect, I think that's one of the mistakes I did make. Although later on in the campaign, I did get a good grip on Italian. I set out to learn Italian, teach myself. And I got on very well with it, but it's all gone now, of course. It's so many years ago, I've never used it since.
How did you learn Italian?
There was a order room colour sergeant and myself. We bought textbooks in Asmara after the fall of Corinne. We were posted into Asmara. And there was a big Woolworth-type shop there, and we bought textbooks and set about studying it in the afternoons and when we weren't doing much work. And later on, we passed notes to each other. We got pretty good. We could write it and talk. Probably halting and lame. It wouldn't be very good to get through to an Italian with. But later on, I did get to know a family in Asmara of Italians, and I could get by with it. You know, it wasn't too hard to make myself understood.
Did you have any joint training exercises with the Sudan Defence Force?
Not that I can remember. There may well have been, and I think I was in a position to have come across it as I was on all these umpire conferences as a clerk. But I don't ever remember the Sudanese Sudan Defence Force taking part in joint exercises with us.
I think though you said in December 1940 you went up to Gallabat.
Yes.
Can you tell me what happened then?
Yes, we were on the Gallabat frontier, just probing and trying to find out the strength of the Italians in that area. I believe at the time General Cunningham was probing from the maybe the south. I'm a bit lost on direction now, but I think he was probing from the south. And we were trying to find out in the Gallabat area and Gonder, which was further into Eritrea and Abyssinia than Gallabat, we were probing around that area and trying to find out if there was any chance of them withdrawing so that we could get a bit further. I think at that time we were after getting to Addis Ababa, the capital, our division. But that was not to be. We got to the capital of the province of Eritrea instead, Asmara. That was after the Battle of Karim.
What was the country like round about Gallabat?
Gallabat, it was long grass, elephant grass and scrub. Not many trees that I can remember. It was a pretty desolate place. But there were a certain amount of the trees that you get gum arabic from. I can't recollect the name of the tree, but we did use to instead of buying gum arabic, we used to collect our own from those trees in that area. We had a good stock of gum arabic in the order room for a long time after that, and I can't remember the name of the tree that it came off.
Did you actually see any Italians in the Gallabat area?
Oh yes, we had visits from the Air Force quite often in some old lumbering machine, a Caproni or something I think they called it. I'm not sure of the name of the air of the airplane, but they did bomb us on occasion at Gallabat. I remember sharing a slit trench with the commanding officer at that time on Christmas Day. 1940, Christmas Day. We got bombed that day, and I do remember sharing a slit trench with him.
What kind of trenches were there?
We had we should dug ourselves about 4 feet deep, and we used to lay logs across diagonally across the trench and leave one end open, leave each end open for blast. And tree trunks which we cut ourselves and laid them across, as I say, crosswise across the trench. I remember we had a sergeant called Bacon who had a pet dog in that particular area, and he used to get used to going into the trenches when the Italians came over. And about that time, one morning the bombers came over and laid a few eggs on us. And the little dog ran in front of his, Sergeant Bacon, they call him, ran into the trench first. And he got hit by a snake, which had been in the slit trench. And after the air raid was over, the dog died. The medical officer tried his best to save it. But it could just as easily have been Maxie Bacon, the sergeant, who got that instead of the dog. But I do remember the poor little dog dying through snake bite.
How many men to a trench?
About 4 normally.
And were they effective against air raids?
Unless you get a direct hit, they were quite good.
What about Italian ground troops? Did you come across those in Gallabat area?
Only the native levies, that's all I saw. I never saw any coloured troops except the coloured officers. There were one or two coloured officers, but they were mostly native levies. Eritrean, Abyssinian levies.
What impression did you get of these levies?
Well, the first time I think it was our A company put an attack in, it'd be east of Gallabat, I think. They couldn't get away quick enough, they ran. Once our lads went in, I think we lost about, we didn't lose any dead, we put a big attack in and lost a few wounded. that they ran the levies, the native levies. We never thought we had much of a job on, really, you know, against the Italians.
Why not?
Morale was high enough, and we knew we weren't fighting class troops like the Germans, and we never rated the Italians, really. We always thought that if it came to the crunch, we were the better troops. We hadn't any misgivings about them at all. We knew we could lick them.
Did you feel they had better equipment?
No, I don't think so. And they hadn't. They had better positions. We were fighting uphill and against strongly fortified hills and mountains. And if the boot had been on the other foot, I think that the Italians would have still been there. They wouldn't have taken the positions off us that we took off them. I'm convinced of that. If it had been German troops there, we would never have taken them.
What type of positions did they construct?
Well, it was hills, fortified hilltops, you see, and we were scaling hills and provisioning troops on top of hills. When our battalion took Fort Dolagodoroc, it was about 10,000 feet, probably 8,000 to 10,000 feet high. And every round of ammunition, every sip of water and bite to eat had to be carried up by a company which was left out of the fighting and designated as porter company. And every night they were climbing the hills, replenishing the troops who were holding the positions and climbing each night, holding up during the day, and then get a bit higher until they were ready to put an attack in on the peak. And eventually it was attacked, and that fort, Dolagodoroc, was taken by the 2nd West Yorks.
Which did the troops prefer to be in, a porter company or a fighting company?
Well, I should think anybody with any sense would want the porter company. It's hard work climbing and fighting, and you're a bit further back. You're not really involved in the bitter fighting. There were casualties, of course, among the porters, but not to the same extent as the A, B and C companies who were... and headquarter company, of course, who were up there, the signals and people like that. They were getting hammered all the time. But the porter work was mostly done at night when there was a definite lull in the fighting, and it was preferable, I should think, to being in the fighting companies.
How long were you in the Galabat area doing this type of work?
I should think we were about a month, 3 weeks to a month before that position. No, that was not Galabat, sorry. We're over to Karen now, and after we'd withdrawn from the Galabat area.
No, I mean the type of probing work that you were describing earlier. How long were you in Galabat doing that?
I should think about 2 months.
And were there any casualties taken amongst the West Yorkshires?
Very few wounded. We had a few. I know one officer, Wyberg, he got wounded in that area. And we had an Indian, sappers and miners, I think he would be, a gentleman called Lieutenant Gabat. And he got the Victoria Cross, helping one of our companies, lifting mines. He was there about 4 days, leading carrier mine lifting, so the rest of the battalion, the rest of the company who were in that area could move. And he was, I think, the first Indian Victoria Cross of the war. Probably the first Victoria Cross, I'm not sure. It was very early days.
What happened after Galabat?
We went by march route and MT to the Karin area for the attack on Fort Dolagodoroc. We were fighting at that time troops commanded by a relative of the King Umberto of Italy, the Duke of Aosta. He was related to royalty, I know.
And was your advance towards Carron opposed?
No, we got into positions at the base. You could see Carron, the place we were after. There was no opposition up to then. All the Italians were sat on top, looking down on us. There was no opposition up to then. But once General Platt, who was the commander-in-chief in Khartoum, once General Platt put his attack in on Khartoum, they were found to be about 20-odd thousand troops in that area for the two divisions to attack, the 4th Indian and the 5th Indian Division.
What positions did the West Yorkshires take up